Okay. If that's okay, I'll now go straight to the New Testament and have a look to check those ideas against the evidence that we've got. Well, firstly, we'll start with the Synoptic Gospels, that's Mark, Matthew and Luke, and we'll have a break and then I'll come back to John later. In many texts, Jesus uses this expression, Son of Man, and you wouldn't know from it that it had anything to do with him. He's talking about Son of Man like the book of Daniel is. He's speaking of it in the third person, out there, and it's, well, I would think clearly his way of speaking, metaphorically or artistically, imaginatively, speaking of the coming judgment. Let me just read you one text, and there are many more. Mark 13:26, for example. In those days, he's talking about the last days, after the time of distress, the sun will be darkened, the moon will lose its brightness, the stars will come falling from heaven, and the powers in heaven will be shaken, and they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory. Then too, he, third person, he will send the angels to gather his chosen from the four winds, from the ends of the world to the ends of heaven. Can you get the feel of the passage? He's talking about the last day and the last judgment, which, in Daniel's terms, is the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven, vindicated by God. You'd think you were reading the book of Daniel. There are a dozen texts in the New Testament that read just like that. But mostly, when Jesus uses the expression Son of Man, there's a reference to himself. He identifies with the title. He identifies with that expression. Let's start looking. And moreover, he uses the expression frequently as a corrective. He uses it to communicate his self-understanding as distinct from other people's faulty understanding of him. The clearest example, perhaps, we'll look at three, and they're all clear, but I think this is perhaps the clearest, is the trial before the Sanhedrin. Mark 14:61-62. The question asked him by the high priest is, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? God. Now, we've already seen many weeks ago that Jesus identified as the Son of God, didn't he? That's a term that made a lot of intimate sense to him, so he could say yes to that. We're going to see in a couple of weeks' time that in some ways Jesus accepted the appellation Christ too as truthful of him, as long as it's properly understood. But both Son of the Blessed One, as understood by the high priest anyhow, and Christ as understood by the high priest could easily be misunderstood. In fact, they were. So Jesus, in his reply, could have simply said yes, but he didn't want to simply say yes, because those two titles are only true as understood in the light of what he says. He says, I am the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven. There's a court, a Sanhedrin. Jesus is in the centre, shackled, being judged by all these heavies who see themselves as important people with important decisions to make. And it's a courtroom, a perfect scene. And they're the judges, and he's the victim, being judged as a heretic, false prophet, and he's going to be murdered. And he totally turns the table. And he, in calling himself the Son of Man, is immediately a term of solidarity. He's identifying with all the persecuted all through history, all who have suffered in the way he's suffering now, all those that he loved and worked with and stood by and loved and tried to support. He says, you will see the Son of Man coming in the power, the right hand of the Father in glory. I, in other words, and those with whom I identify, are going to be vindicated by God, and you, he's saying to the court, are going to be judged by what you're doing here today. A second text which bears on the same point is Caesarea Philippi, Mark 8:30 and the following, where Jesus in fact asks the very question, who do you say I am? Who am I for you? A really beautiful question that keeps haunting us all through this course. Peter comes up with a title we haven't yet examined, because I don't think we're ready for it yet, but he says, you are the Christ. Okay, maybe, as long as Pete understands it. We're going to very soon see Pete doesn't understand it. Because as soon as Jesus explains what it is, he won't have it. He says, oh, not that. So Peter has come up with something that he thinks he understands. It's partly right, partly wrong. How is Jesus going to help Peter see the perspective within which to hold that? He says, Jesus began to teach them that, and here comes the Son of Man. That's what he wants them to know he is. Was destined to suffer grievously, to be rejected, etc., and put to death, and after 3 days to rise again. And he goes on talking to them about, it's not the one who holds his life who finds it, it's the one who wastes it, who gives it to others, who spends himself in love and so on, who will find his life. And he concludes, if anyone, a real powerful judgment here, if anyone in this adulterous and sinful generation is ashamed of me and of my words, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him when he comes in the glory of his Father and the holy angels. In other words, a frightening statement in a way, except when you listen to who's saying it, and the way he says it, Jesus is saying, the words that I'm telling you, Peter, now, at this really intimate moment of recognition and affirmation and so on, openness to who Jesus is, what I'm telling you, Peter, about myself is just so important that the whole of history is going to be judged on it, the whole of your life is going to be judged on it. It's ultimately radically, totally important for you to know who I am and to know the meaning of it. And I am the Son of Man. My words are words on which your whole life's going to be judged, but they're words spoken by someone who identifies with the poor, downcast, persecuted, and so on. I hope you're finding that convincing. I do. And just to finally, on this point, a third text, which comes immediately after that one, comes out the same way. Just after that passage I've read to you about Caesarea Philippi, the recognition of Jesus as the Christ, and the talk about suffering servant material, really, Jesus goes up onto the mountain with Peter, James, and John, and is transfigured before them. And in that, for the first time, they are drawn into Jesus' prayer. For the first time, they are engaged by God in the cloud, as it were, taken into that cloud of unknowing. They have a mystical experience. And the central point of the mystical experience is, this is my Son, the Beloved. This is my Son. This, the one that's been talking to, the Son of Man person, one who's going to be grievously hurt and who will rise on the third day. He, this one, is my Son, the Beloved. Listen to him. And just straight after the mountain experience, as they came down from the mountain, Jesus warned them to tell no one what they had seen until after the Son of Man had risen from the dead. In other words, Jesus' identity, Jesus' own self-understanding, is to be, one way I like to see it, is the journey between the two baptisms. The first baptism, which we've already studied, was the baptism at the Jordan River. An overwhelming experience of love, you are my son, an overwhelming experience of the Abba, his father, an overwhelming experience of a mission to spread the good news, which began Jesus on his career. 2 years later, there's another baptism. He spoke of it in Mark chapter 10, 42 or something. I have a baptism wherewith I must be baptized, and how I am straitened, how I am anxious until it be accomplished. And sorry, that's the quotation from Luke. The quotation in Mark is when he says to James and John, are you willing to be baptized with the baptism wherewith I must be baptized with you? Remember the phrase. The overwhelming pain of death, the overwhelming suffering of the cross, the overwhelming, not despair, but what could engender despair of what was going to happen to him on the cross. That's the journey between those two is a journey of fidelity, a journey of identification with the poor, and a judgment of the world, a loving judgment of the world, but a loving judgment will bring him eventually to the trial himself. Just a few more texts now to perhaps help your meditation, taking this point by point. Some texts in which the identification with the suffering poor is very clearly indicated. In Matthew 8:20, for example. Foxes have holes, and the birds of the air have nests. The Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Matthew 11:19. The Son of Man came eating and drinking. And they said, look, he's a glutton and a drunkard and a friend of tax collectors and sinners. A really humble title of solidarity with the oppressed. The Son of Man came to give his life as a ransom for many. Not for a few, not for a chosen remnant, but for the multitudes, for many. In fact, for anyone who wanted to take it in, anyone who had ears to hear. He came to give his life for anyone who need, which is everyone, I suppose. And that rather, well, very beautiful statement in Luke 19:10, after that scene with Zacchaeus, where he concludes, and it's right at the end of the public ministry of Jesus, the Son of Man has come to seek out and save what was lost. A kind of good shepherd image of someone who whose care and concern from Yahweh, the Redeemer God, is to go out to the loneliest and the oppressed and the lost and gather them in to live to the full. So there's a simple point, eh? Clearly using the term in a way of identification with the oppressed. Second point, which I've covered already, but just a few texts that might help your meditation, is this term is used by Jesus in relation to judgment, which is the other angle to this term. For example, when he authoritatively forgives sins in that paralyzed man in Mark chapter 2, the term he uses of himself there is again Son of Man. In other words, this is God's judgment being effected here in his ministry. Ultimately, the judgment's going to be at the end of time. On the clouds of heaven, yes? The synoptics are looking forward to a judgment that has to come eventually. But even now, in Jesus' ministry, he's bringing about the kingdom of God, the reign of God in his life. He's, by his miracles, by his healing, by his judgment, he's already starting the process going. And there's an example. The Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sin. And likewise, when he saw people being oppressed, yoked, caught by the religious requirements of the church of the day, which had value, but had missed the central value of mercy. He says, the Son of Man is master even of the Sabbath. A strong term, powerful term, judgment term of this one who's identifying with the poor. Thirdly, again and again, the Son of Man term is used by Jesus in a way that absolutely parallels the suffering servant of Yahweh, the one who will be glorified finally because of his fidelity and obedience to the will of God here. We're taking a simple example from Mark 9:31, there are many others. The Son of Man will be delivered into the hands of men. They will put him to death, but after 3 days he will rise again. He is identifying with the poor. He'll suffer with them. He'll go down with them. But he will be vindicated with them. And so Son of Man is almost a title, not just for himself, but for himself and all those with whom he identifies. And finally, in the Synoptics, perhaps one of the, I think it's one of the most powerful scenes that indicate Jesus' own sense of his own mission and therefore his own identity. And I'll read you the whole passage, if I may, for the final verses of which are highly significant and are the last contribution I want to make on the Synoptics here. The scene is Mark 10, 35 to 45. It's a scene, it's about judgment, it's about the ultimate purpose of life, it's about our goal, it's about what we want, it's got all those ramifications in it, and Jesus puts his finger right on the very, very central key aspect of the purpose of all of our lives and the central thrust of his own mission. James and John, the sons of Zebedee, approached him. Master, they said to him, we want you to do us a favor. He said to them, what is it you want me to do for you? Always inviting them, not presuming, not knowing, and not getting in early, allowing them to find their own words at their own time and respecting where they're at. He says, well, what do you want? What is it? And they, understandably, but as will soon appear rather foolishly, say, allow us to sit one at your right hand and the other at your left in your glory. We like you and we'd like to be prime minister and second in charge in heaven or whatever, you know, right, the top places in the whole thing. Childish, but okay. Jesus says, with something of a smile surely, taken aback by their brash and rather innocent, guileless stupidity, says, you don't know what you're asking. Can you drink the cup that I must drink? Can you be baptized with the baptism with which I must be baptized? I remember as a little boy, I keep remembering whenever I have this phrase, I'll share it with you if you don't mind. My mother was in the Legion of Mary and was effectively parish priest for years, which is common enough, as you know, and doing all the visitation, and I thought she was parish priest till I found out you can't be. But she used to have to, and the father was a lovely man, but wasn't able to come to these particular meetings, so Mum had to do all the sermons as well, and she did it rather nicely. But we as little kids used to cop the sermon before anyone else did. She'd try it out on the family. And isn't it interesting? I'm talking about when I was 6 or 7 or 8, I'm sure. I had to be certainly not older than that. And I remember quite a lot of those sermons. Little images like this, that remember her saying that they wanted to be on the right and the left in Jesus' glory. But Jesus' moment of glory was the cross. And who was on the right and on the left then? Now, the thieves on the cross, as it were, you know, crucified with him. And actually, the more I know about Scripture, the more Mum's insight was totally right. Like, he's saying, can you be baptized to be with Jesus in his glory? He's saying, do you realize what you're asking? Do you want to be nailed to crosses on both sides of me? You know, really? And they think at all, I'm not too sure about that. They had something else in mind at the time. Anyhow, back, leave my childhood memories and back to this. But I think it shows you that kids listen more than mums and dads often realise, and it's probably good not to leave them a victim of television only. They replied, we can. And Jesus said to them, the cup that I must drink, you shall drink. And with the baptism with which I must be baptised, you shall be baptised. But as for seats at my right hand or my left, they're not mine to grant. They belong to those to whom they have been allotted. And now we come to this key part of it. When the other 10 heard this, they began to feel indignant with James and John. So Jesus called them to him and said, you know, they were worse than the two, weren't they? Because at least the two were guileless enough to come out into the open and with their ambitions. But the other 10 who wouldn't bemean themselves to ask such a stupid question really wanted it and were bitching away there quite angry that these two had kind of got in ahead or whatever. So, you know, he said, that among the pagans, their so-called rulers lord it over them and their great men make their authority felt. This is not to happen among you. Anyone who wants to become great among you must be a servant. Anyone who wants to be first among you must be a slave to all. For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Nowhere does Jesus more clearly state his own understanding of what he was on about. So let's look at it at some length. The Son of Man, here's our title, identification with the poor, but also hope in a vindication from the judgment of God. So a trusting, powerful position, but as identifying with the oppressed, came. Why? Why? How did Jesus see himself? What was he on about? What did he think he was doing? He didn't come to be served, he said. But he came to serve. And that means, in fact, to give his life as a ransom for many. So what we've got to do now is have a look at this word. The Greek verb to serve is diakonein. A person who does service, the deacon in English, is the diakonos. And diakonia means service. So they're the three Greek words related. What do they mean in the New Testament? Very important question today when we're always talking about ministry, which is the same, another English word for service, eh? Lay ministry, parochial ministry, parish ministry. What essentially is ministry? Now, we all know that what we mean by ministry is what Jesus did, obviously. Now, what did Jesus understand? What's the New Testament see it as? It's not all that obscure, so let me try and put it to you. When we use the word service, check this for yourself, I'll just tell you what seems to me to happen. When we use the word service, when I use it anyhow, I think of other people's need. That's centre. You can't serve people the way you think they need serving. You've got to start with their needs, I would have thought. And serving means, I suppose, meeting their need. Secondly, serving has a connotations of humility, caring, service, doing things for others, not from a high hand, serving others, humility and kind of servility perhaps, being a servant of all, being a slave to other people, being the last person and so on, all those connotations, Jesus washing feet at the Last Supper image, okay? That seems to me to be in our mind, my mind in here. That's not the key element in the diakonia. In the Greek mythology, Hermes is the diakonos. Hermes, if you've read your mythology, is the messenger of the gods, the winged messenger of the gods. Hermes' task was to bring messengers from heaven to earth, to reveal on earth the will of the gods, and to effect it, to bring it out, to go to the clouds and tell them to and the thunder, and generally ensure that there's a connection between the almighty will of these gods of the Olympus and the happenings on earth. He's the go-between. The word diakonia means to go between, means to go to and fro, carrying out the will of a master. It's sometimes said that it means, and I've said this myself till I knew better, that it means service at table, a servant at table. Unfortunately, that's not true. It means bringing things from the kitchen to the table, because it's going between, like you can see how analogically it has that image of movement going to and fro. And it is used at a meal when it's a sacred meal, when it's a religious meal, when the gods are being manifested here and we are communing with the gods, then the servant of the master is the one doing the will of God and revealing it in this sacred dance, ritual, a ceremonial high banquet. So come to my last point, I hope it's clear. Diakonos does not concentrate on need. It concentrates on the will of God. A diakonos is one who sees and is a vehicle of and administers the will of God. And that's why, I think I'm right in saying this, at least my present reflections go this way, that in the church we don't ever start from need. We start from gift. We're very aware of need. I mean, be stupid not to be, of course. That's totally important. But that's not where you start, because if I start with the needs around me, and just because they're needs, does that mean I can meet them? I can run around and do a whole lot of things and get in everybody's road out of just sheer desire to meet people's needs. No, St. Paul writes in the New Testament, you have to help me discern my gift. What can I give the needy world? And people mightn't even be aware of the needs. Did people know they needed Jesus before he came? Do I know my need till you turn up? I might think my need is for money or peace and quiet, or I don't know what I think it is. And then someone loves me, and my needs can change very rapidly and very quickly. I get a whole new vision, a whole new horizon opens up. And the church's function in the world is to awaken need that we mightn't have ever known about, by presenting possibilities of love and presenting a gift, and each one of us discerning our gift. Otherwise we despair, we get heavy-hearted, we think we should be doing things, we all try and be like Mother Teresa, we all try and be like St. Francis of Assisi, we all try and be like some saint we've read about, instead of being the most beautiful thing you can be, which is you. And giving. And the widow would have come along with her 2 cent pieces, you know, in the Mark chapter whatever, 10, everything is 10, and her 2 cent pieces, and she wouldn't have put them in. She would have been so embarrassed, because she would have seen all these other people putting gold into the temple treasury, and she would have thought, oh, I don't want my 2 cent pieces, and she would have gone away and cried and just done nothing and felt useless. But if you start from gift, you never feel useless, do you? Just because a violet can't give shade, I mean it can to a slug, but it doesn't give much shade. Anyhow, it's so tiny and near the ground. Just because a violet doesn't give shade, there's no need for it to kind of, I was going to say blush, but that's getting a bit... So what about giving shade? There's a lot of other beautiful things to do, like pop up through the green and say, hey, look at me, this purple little thing here, how are you? Or something. I'm going a little beyond where I am, but I'm just trying... Let me come back then to Jesus. When he called himself a servant, yes, he was humble, but that's not what this word says. Yes, he did reach out to people in need, but that's not what this word says. This word says he obeyed the will of his Father. And because his Father is the Redeemer, God, who cares for the poor, of course Jesus cared for the poor. Of course Jesus was a Redeemer. Of course he gave his life. Gave it on the cross, finally. And it doesn't mean die. Giving your life is not the same as dying, surely. He gave his life on the cross, and he gave it the night before at the Eucharist, and he gave it 2 days before, and he gave it to a leper. To love is to share yourself in order to give life to others, isn't it? So he gave his life at every moment of his life in the most beautiful way. He was gifted by God to do it at that moment in that situation. And that's his vision of what he is called to be. It is also a humble task. It is also about need. But it's primarily and centrally about gift, will, revelation. And when Paul, for example, calls himself in 1 Corinthians, text evades me, I can't think where it is, it's fairly early on, I think it's chapter 3, who is Paul? Who is Apollos? He says, we are servants. And if you remember, he was mistaken for Hermes by the pagans in the city somewhere out at Thyatira or somewhere. And a servant is that's where our English gets mucked up. A servant sounds like a little lowly word, doesn't it? When he called himself a diakonos, he was saying, I am revealing God's will to you. No tiny little word at all, but an enormously powerful revelationary word. It so happens that the will of God that is being revealed is about service in the other sense of English. It's about how you're humble, life-giving, redeeming, ransoming gift of oneself. The Son of Man, then, as a concluding remark to the synoptic use, has three elements in it. One, it's about judgment. It's about the redemption of the faithful poor, the vindication of the faithful poor, which is finally in the future, when the clouds of heaven are when the books are opened, and so on, the ultimate judgment. But even now, in Jesus' ministry, in the forgiving of sins, in the declarations concerning the Torah, Jesus is effecting God's judgment already here, imminently among us. Secondly, there's the element of the identification with the oppressed. And thirdly, it's a title, the diakonia, the Son of Man came to serve. It's to do with revelation, obedience, and perhaps thy will be done, as in heaven, so on earth, effecting God's will here.